Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In a minute or two, George Joseph will discuss how and why cops get away with murder. And then Draco Larimore Hall will examine the rise of the far right in Sweden. First, cops. We know they get away with extraordinary violence, so much so that it's become routine. It turns out that most acts of violence are committed by a small minority of officers. But far from being the proverbial bad apples, they're behaving in ways that help them rise in the ranks. If you want to ascend beyond walking a beat, you have to make a lot of arrests, and that generally means being confrontational. And being confrontational often means beatings and death. My first guest, George Joseph, is a staff reporter for The Appeal. He's a co-author of a story on that site based on access to a database of incidents of cop violence compiled by the Columbus, Ohio Police Department. They found that 6% of the officers account for half of such events, and 99% of these acts of violence were ruled acceptable. When this interview was recorded a couple of days ago, Joseph and his colleagues at The Appeal initially thought the database was compiled solely from citizen complaints, but they have since learned that it also includes reports from cops themselves. Here's George Joseph, who was last in the show a couple of years ago, to describe how Teach for America has been expanding into India with more. Columbus, Ohio. Let's start, just say a few words about that. What's that city like, and how representative of the U.S. is it?
Well, it's a fairly large city. It's 40% non-white, which is an important issue for the story. Yet the police department does not reflect the population in any significant way. Its leadership, for example, is completely white. And a lot of our sources within the Columbus Police Department, or a division of police, sort of say that that pattern reflects the larger issues of how the police there don't really represent or engage with the community meaningfully.
And you focus in your story on the shooting of Tyre King, right? That was a national story. Like, remind us what happened there.
So Tyre King was a 13-year-old who was the victim of a police shooting. The circumstances of the shooting were a group of officers were responding to a call about a robbery involving a group of teenagers. The person who called the police said, "I'm not going to stress over it," something to that effect, because it was $10. Yet you have these officers going in guns blazing to go after this group of kids. And so they end up chasing these kids, and two of them get away. But the third, Tyre King, who's a child, 13 years old, ends up in an alley facing them. And it's a classic situation where the officers say he pulled what appeared to be a gun out of his waistband, and his friends who were there say he was trying to run away. At some point, he shot multiple times. Autopsy conducted by the family indicated that he was attempting to run away when the shooting took place, and he was killed.
And now this has become, by now, a familiar story. I mean, mm-hmm. This happens, it seems like, every week.
It's not in the news anymore.
Yeah, it's just become...
It just happens and nothing...
Yeah, a dog bites man story now.
Yeah.
But in this case... It's very representative in a lot of ways. Tell us about the cop who shot Tyre King.
So one of the officers involved, Brian Mason, who ended up shooting him, is an officer who, as local news outlets reported, had gotten several commendations, letters from the departmental heads. Yet also, as records we obtained show, had 47 force complaints, incidents involving alleged uses of force by civilians filed against him.
And I assume that's a big number.
That's a big number, yes. Even up for the Columbus Division of Police's standards, that's a fairly big number. And he also ranked in our estimates among the 99th percentile in terms of officers involved in shootings in the department. So there are clear warning signs of a guy who, over and over again in only a period of 7 years, he wasn't that much of a veteran, had gotten into numerous incidents allegedly involving force, yet all of them except for one in our data set, which is listed as pending, were found to be unsustained by the department.
What kind of episodes are we talking about?
We're talking about macings, hittings, shootings, So two shootings before this fatal shooting.
And the general pattern is that a very small percentage of officers are responsible for the lion's share of complaints, right?
Yeah, so that's the interesting finding of our article. Of the 20,000 complaints we had, as I mentioned, 99% of them, the department decided there was no merit to them. However, those complaints are being generated by a very small, quote-unquote, bad apples section of the division. And in the years where the data is fullest and clearest, what we can say is...
And you have about 13, 14 years of data?
We have 17, 18, but the latter years, for whatever reason, don't seem to be complete. So for the purpose of this analysis, we looked at 2001 to 2014, and what we found was, on average, annually, about 6% of the force of sworn officers accounted for half of all incidents that generated complaints involving force.
And that number, 20,000, you know, Columbus is not a large city. That's a large number of complaints. So like these guys really do have a lot of run-ins with a citizen.
Yeah, there's a lot of officers who have 30, 40, 50 complaints. It's not a handful. There's a lot.
And you quote a couple of people in the story saying that actually citizens are very unlikely to complain dishonestly, that there's actually reason to believe these complaints.
Yeah, these are interviews we did with officers themselves who were in Columbus, and their assessment is, yes, there's certain times where a civilian will lie or say something untrue about an incident. However, you can't say that 99% of the time, thousands of times, civilians are all lying about force cases. So their argument is the police department just doesn't care, and so they don't sustain these allegations. But more importantly, the police department actually views that kind of aggressive, proactive policing as what good policing is. And so how can you punish an officer for doing more or less what he's rewarded for doing within the division?
In other words, if you're not pissing people off, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, you're seen as being lazy. You're seen as not being proactive. You're not getting in there. These are the kind of terms that officers will use when talking to us.
And this is the way to get promoted.
This is the way to get promoted, yeah. And even when you get involved in a nasty incident that makes national headlines, you're not actually put in a punishing assignment role like desk duty or standing around on an ugly street corner. You even can go to high coveted units, narcotics units. That's the kind of thing that we showed in the article.
Yeah, I noticed that narcotics is highly prized. Any reason for that you know of?
I think it's money, first of all. And second of all, just doing more sort of intelligence-led work where you're able to think more, not just be responding to things like on a beat patrol kind of capacity is more prestigious.
Of course, the cynical view would be it's easy to steal drugs and use them or sell them.
Well, we do see that in major American cities across the country, particularly Baltimore and Chicago. I haven't seen that in more, quote-unquote, normal cities like Columbus, where there's not nearly the same amount of shootings or gang activity. But that does happen, yes.
Yeah, generally, what's the crime scene like in Columbus? It's not what you'd think of as a really high-crime city, is it?
I'm not an expert in Columbus crime statistics, but I will say that it doesn't rank anywhere near the amount of murders per 100,000 that some of our top cities do.
And so how representative is this kind of situation?
So beyond Columbus, there's been several reports in major cities across the country that find similarly that a fairly small percentage of the force accounts for a large percentage of violent incidents. So in New York a few months ago, I reported on how plainclothes officers, which we estimate to be roughly 6% of the force in the NYPD, account for a third of all fatal shootings in recent years. Similarly, in Chicago, another Intercept piece found that only 129 or 130 officers accounted for roughly a third of fatal shootings. So what we see is that these specialized units involving plainclothes officers who are jumping out of their cars, going to try to grab guns, find drugs, that kind of thing, very aggressive tactics, result in violent altercations, unsurprisingly, and abusive incidents, which lead to complaints.
I'm speaking with George Joseph, a staff reporter for The Appeal.
And the fact that they're in these elite units, these plum jobs, suggests that this kind of behavior really is the way up the ranks.
It is. You have to get into those kind of units, then become a detective, and then you become a higher up in the department by sort of going through that prestige ladder. Yeah.
And what kind of procedures does Columbus or do other cities have for dealing with these kinds of behaviors? I mean, are they really any kind of accountability or discipline, or is it a blank check?
Well, as we noted in our article, 99% of these forced complaints are found to be unsustained. So while there is a formal policy where they'll do investigations and supposedly talk to the people involved, it's almost a meaningless system because nothing ever gets through. And officers we spoke to acknowledge that. And one point they'd bring up is that when you look even at the leadership of the department, who, again, as we mentioned, go through this sort of similar incentive structure, they themselves, several of them, have had numerous forced complaints. And so to expect people who succeeded in the department by or while having many forced complaints to then turn around and punish others for trying to do the same thing as them is not very likely.
And it makes me uncomfortable to say this, given my fondness for unions, but the police unions are not angels in this situation, are they?
Yeah, the police unions, it's an interesting history. From what I've read, in the 70s, during the cities across the country facing municipal crises, they started bargaining away from bread and butter issues, which the cities weren't going to give them, to more policy power things, such as undermining the ability of officers to be held accountable after a violent incident happens. And so that trend has only continued across the country in the decades since. And, for example, in Columbus, where we focus, the union contract doesn't allow for complaints that have been unsustained to be used in discipline. And so even an officer like the one we profiled, Mr. Mason, who has had 47 forced complaints in the past, all of which have been unsustained, that evidence can't be considered the next time he engages in a violent incident, allegedly with a civilian.
What does this say about the culture of American policing?
Well, it speaks to what some scholars would argue is a fairly narrow view of what good policing is. Grabbing the guns, grabbing the drugs. The idea is that doing that, one, stops the ability of people to deal drugs and to acquire guns, which is obviously not true. There's plenty of empirical evidence showing it does almost nothing. And two, the idea is that it serves as a deterrent effect. But, you know, community activists will argue that while they're doing that and attempting to deter people, people on the ground who aren't necessarily involved in crime are being caught up in this dragnet of policing, which then dramatically changes their life outcomes because they'll get a summons and they will then fail to show up to court and then they'll have a warrant. And these kind of cascading consequences will then create many of the criminal records that you're seeking to deter people from having in the first place.
Well, then cops also seem to have this worldview, like it's the good guys against the bad guys. They've got, like, you know, a 5-year-old view of the world, it seems.
Well, what I'll say is that officers are in a tough position where the tools that they're given and encouraged to use effectively mean that they aren't going to be trusted in the community, and they aren't going to necessarily even be able to do what they thought they signed up for. For example, being a physical presence in the community that people can turn to for safety. And so in those kind of conditions, people lash out at them, as we've seen over the years, and then us versus them mentality is developed. And so it's hard to imagine that way of thinking will ever change as long as people at the top of these departments and at sort of the city level feel that the best way to address generational cycles of violence is to simply go into communities and grab as much as you can.
This seems just like almost inevitable, given what a violent and polarized society this is. It's hard to imagine a way out of this. But is there some credible agenda for reform that could reduce this vicious cycle?
Well, it's strange. A few years ago, people thought we were in this midst of police reform, right? And then the election happened, and Jeff Sessions is made attorney general and cancels all the investigations into police departments that had previously been found to be engaging in overtly racist practices, and has been going around the country speaking with district attorneys and cops, telling them, we need to stop being soft on crime. It's almost like with everything in our politics, a recycled rhetoric from the Reagan era. And so what little hope there was of reform at the city or state level, even for officers, when I speak to them, that hope seems to have died.
Yes, you know, but the murder rate in New York City is down like 90% from its peak, yet still the politics hasn't really caught up with that fact, it seems.
Well, I think there's an institutional reason for that, in that as you grow and outlive your purposes in some way, you still need to do something. You still need to show you're making your numbers. You still need to show that you're getting your arrests and summonses, because back in the 80s and 90s, that was the theory of how to stop crime. And even when there isn't really any crime, you still have to keep stopping crime. And so all these strange encounters, unnecessary encounters are happening. People are getting arrested for jumping a turnstile or for riding on their bike in the sidewalk because police are being told that these are the hot spots of crime. You need to go and show that you're doing some activity there. That way, when I go to my commander, I don't get chewed out for not doing anything. And so there's this fossil of an institutional structure that certainly is much slower to change than what crime trends would suggest.
Yeah, on paper, we have mechanisms whereby these cops are supposed to be accountable, but in reality, they're not, right?
Well, there's very little civilian oversight of police generally, and even when there are review boards, as you know from New York, they rarely can actually make enforcement decisions about what happens. And so when you trust an institution to police itself, whether it be the police or the Catholic Church, it's very unlikely anything's going to change.
I was George Joseph, a staff reporter for The Appeal. You can find his story, co-written with Ethan Corey, on The Appeal's website, theappeal.org. The Appeal is a newish website focusing on criminal justice and mass incarceration, with an emphasis on state and local government, where most of the action happens. Just for the record, since the topic came up in the interview, according to FBI statistics, Columbus has a murder rate of 12 per 100,000 residents, below Oakland's 20, but well above San Francisco's 7 and New York's 4. New York's murder rate, the lowest since 1951, is now running below London's in some months. But next to Baltimore's 51 and St. Louis's 60, Columbus is pretty peaceful. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some have called the police by LCD sound system. I thought the title seemed relevant, but those lyrics won't win any awards for coherence, nor would they earn a mention in an updated edition of Seven Types of Ambiguity. But it's fun to listen to. Next, Sweden, that bastion of social democracy where the right is on the rise. Sweden is not alone in this, of course. Other Scandinavian countries are seeing the same, as are many countries in continental Europe. The flashpoint is immigration, a xenophobia Americans are familiar with, but there are deeper causes, like austerity and the rightward turn of center-left parties, although, as we'll hear, that rightward turn is less severe in Sweden than elsewhere. For decades, the Social Democratic Party dominated Swedish politics, but its dominance has been challenged by the so-called Moderate Party in recent decades. The Moderates were previously known as the rightist party until it reinvented itself in the 1960s. While in power, the Social Democrats created a formidable welfare state, but with the increasing pressures of globalization and the rightward move of politics around the world, the welfare state came under challenge and the Social Democrats lost their lock on power. The Sweden Democrats were founded in 1988, but they have their roots in white nationalism and fascism. They now officially reject those roots, but they still show. The Democrats have been rising in prominence along with their compatriots abroad, Le Pen in France, the AfD in Germany, and Trump in the USA. In the last general election, 2014, they got 13% of the parliamentary vote. In this recent September 9th election, they got almost 18%, which was slightly below what they were polling just before the election and down from a peak of around 25% several weeks earlier. Their result was the third highest of the parties, behind the Social Democrats at 28 and the Moderates at 20. Several other parties split the rest, including the Left Party with 8% and the Greens with 4%. While 18% might not sound all that alarming, it's not an insignificant share either, and these far-right messages are often picked up by mainstream parties in an effort to undercut their appeal. For a closer look, let's turn to Jaakko Laramore Hall. Jaakko is one of two vice chairs of the California Democratic Party, an affiliation I try, out of a spirit of generosity and fellow feeling, to overlook. He's also a consultant to social democratic parties and unions in Europe, including the Swedish Social Dems. He's a frequent visitor in Sweden. He spent 3 weeks before the election there, working with the Social Democrats. Jaakko Laramore Hall.
I believe you've said in the past that what Cuba is for some leftists, Sweden is to you. How did you acquire this fondness for Sweden, and what precisely does the country mean to you?
You know, Sweden is kind of the international symbol of the policy success and the social movement success of social democracy and the labor movement. And, you know, it's a place where those movements have, you know, really institutionalized their ideas and working methods to an extent that we don't really see elsewhere. To sort of borrow an old term from an allied movement, I've always seen the Nordic countries as examples of actually existing social democracy. And so, you know, worth paying attention to and defending and deepening. And has been under tremendous, tremendous strain and attack from forces of globalization and changes in the global economy that make some of their traditional economic strategies a little trickier, but also from within, both from an increasingly neoliberal center-right, and now more recently in the last decade or so, a very aggressive, intelligent, and strategic racist and xenophobic right.
I noticed you said actually existing social democracy and not socialism. We should emphasize that despite, you know, heavy taxation and regulation, the Swedish economy still is largely in private hands, right?
Correct. Although, you know, if you look at the percentage of GDP that flows through public hands, both in terms of the state and a heavily regulated labor market, or heavily organized, I should say, labor market. Yeah, it's a market system. But really a market system that's been bent to the will of progressive forces and the labor movement, but by all means is a capitalist economy in its foundations, for sure.
And, you know, I should say, although, you know, in my heart of hearts, I still remain a socialist, I'd have to say that if Americans woke up tomorrow and had a social structure somewhat like Sweden's, we would think some kind of revolution had happened.
Exactly, and that's kind of my approach. I mean, I also consider myself to be a democratic socialist in terms of my politics and my analysis of the world and so forth, but in terms of how to translate that into, you know, real progress for people that is democratic and doesn't involve a lot of guns and prisons, this is where socialism as a set of ideas or values has governed successfully and has really transformed the way that capitalism works, I think, in some pretty awesome and fundamental ways. But without, you know, a broader movement and without, you know, having, frankly, a bunch of voters who don't care about defending capitalism per se, making these kinds of gains within a social democratic context are impossible. Social democracy needs socialism. Socialism needs social democracy. That's how I've always seen it.
In my can't we all get along sort of mood, I
feel fair enough.
That warms my heart. But it's funny you mentioned guns and prisons, because we have plenty of those, and we're pretty far from utopia.
Absolutely.
Sweden, as many of the other Nordic countries are experiencing, they've seen a lot of neoliberal kinds of reforms in recent years, and also a rise of right-wing anti-immigrant tendencies in the polity. Are these things related, the neoliberal reforms and the rise of the right?
Yeah, I think that just like in the United States, you can't really tell the story of the rise. Talking about the rise of racist politics in the United States feels silly, right? Because it's just always been there. It's in the political DNA of the country. But the recent electoral success of a kind of brazenly xenophobic and white nationalist politics that we see in Trump, you can't tell that story without talking about the depletion of services and policies that help working families and help working people. You can't talk about it without talking about economic inequality and economic anxiety. But you also can't talk about it without, you know, just looking really soberly at racism and racist discourse, white anxiety, male anxiety, all of these things. I mean, I tend in trying to think about the rise of the xenophobic right in Europe, I tend to think that almost everybody who comments on it has a point. And everybody's right. The fact that this is a global trend, that there's so many parallels between what's happening everywhere from Sweden to Greece to Minnesota, shows that there's got to be some set of social changes, broader social changes, economics changes, and so forth, that are behind this and driving this. If someone tries to make a just very rudimentary relationship between neoliberalism or austerity and the rise of the right, we have plenty of counterexamples if you look community by community. At the same time, there's got to be some explanation for why all of a sudden somebody coming out and saying, hey, everything in your life that's bad is the immigrant's fault, is salient and attractive to voters. But there's an economic underpinning or an economic aspect to what's going on here, and also a cultural and social one that really is about people with actually pretty decent standards of living, looking around and seeing people look different, hearing different languages, and being freaked out about it. So both of these things are working together.
Yeah, and if people didn't feel under some kind of threat, their normal discomfort with people who don't look and talk like them might have been kept under wraps. But when they feel under threat and stress, then those things come to the fore. And it's very easy to blame foreigners for your problems. That's the easy way out. If you don't want to think about what the homegrown issues are. Now, let's talk a bit about the Democrats, the Sweden Democrats. Who are they? What's their history? Where did they come from?
So the Sweden Democrats are the latest in a string of attempts by really nasty far-right forces in Swedish society to enter the electoral arena. And really, unlike their sister parties, you could say, or their counterparts in Norway and Denmark, where the xenophobia was kind of like added on to a populist anti-tax, a libertarian push. The Sweden Democrats' roots really are in the neo-Nazi movement and really are in the explicitly racist, white supremacist elements. They got haircuts. They got suits. They've been extremely well trained in communication. They paid attention to, you know, how to use social media, how to use the existing media, in a way that the other end just left the other parties completely flat-footed. And this has allowed them to just be making steady gains in the last several elections. Sort of like Trump, we see that even though they've lost hundreds, literally in the last term, hundreds of their politicians at the national all the way down to the local level in small towns and communities have had to resign because it's come out that they're, you know, literal Nazis, or they've beaten somebody up, or they've sexually assaulted people. I mean, these are just real thugs, real scumbags. And yet people, you know, their voting base doesn't care. It's very analogous to what seems increasingly true, that Trump is absolutely right, that you could go and like shoot someone in the face and his base would be fine with that.
This is a selling point to some people, right? I mean, they're shocking bourgeois norms. They're saying the things you're not supposed to say, and they're doing the things you're not supposed to do.
That's exactly right. And so you have a lot of their voters, and I think this is true across the world, who don't necessarily agree with everything they're saying. They're not, you know, in their daily lives, they're not like particularly racist. They don't think that they could actually achieve the things that they promise, but they're saying something. They're saying it. Like, they're just, people are glad that somebody's in there just telling it like it is and calling things out and saying that there needs to be a massive shift. And because the Sweden Democrats don't come from, say, a tax revolt, the way that the Danes and Norwegian far-right parties have, it leaves them with this tremendous flexibility policy-wise to tack to the right or the left on economic policy, on social policy, and just hammer away at the migration issue, the integration issues, the crime issues that are their bread and butter. And the Social Democrats made, I think, a just tremendous strategic blunder in this election cycle, where they started the election campaign in the spring sounding more and more like the Sweden Democrats. They took tough rhetoric and tough policies when it came to crime, when it came to migration, when it came to integration. And you can actually look at the opinion polls for over the last year that they got hammered in the opinion polls as a result. You know, what felt somewhat like a success on election night was really just us making up the ground that we had lost in the spring while we were sounding like the Sweden Democrats. That, to me, is a very, very important lesson for social democratic and progressive parties across Europe and across the world. When we sound like them, when we try to sound like them, we just give them another echo. We just bolster their talking points. And where we were successful and started to make that up was when we started to sound again like social democrats. We came out for an additional week off of work for all parents. We reversed real mistakes that we'd made in the 90s with advocating privatization and profit seeking in welfare services, and made actually getting rid of profit seeking and venture capital in the welfare system a key part of our campaign. And, you know, we're able to make up a bit of that dip and, you know, survived election night to fight on.
One of the mechanisms by which these far-right parties spread their poison is by moving the more mainstream parties in their direction, right? We've seen that repeatedly, and now we've even seen the members of Die Linke in Germany embracing some of the AfD policies.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that we really need to be careful about, and we need to watch, and I think is real tricky for leftists in the United States to get their head around, because you know, in terms of different responses to far-right populism, there's a real range. And one of the options that's on the table, and we see this in Denmark and then emerging with this new cross-party movement idea in Germany, is, hey, let's move to the left on economic issues. Let's sound like good traditional social democrats when it comes to class, when it comes to anti-corporate politics. But let's also adopt xenophobic rhetoric and xenophobic policies. The Danish Social Democrats have seen their support skyrocket in the polls since they've taken that line, and now there's an attempt to do that in Germany. What we really need to do is have the bravery to stand on principle when it comes to issues of racism and xenophobia and migrant rights and so forth, while also supplementing that with popular social democratic policies. It may mean that it'll take a little while to get, or a little longer to get out of the wilderness. But in the long run, that's both the more moral approach, but also it's the more strategic one, because these migrants that are coming into Europe, they're staying, they're having children, they're getting voting rights themselves. They are a tremendous base of support for the left. I mean, the neighborhoods in Stockholm that are overwhelmingly majority minority, the Social Democrats get 60-70%. Of the vote. And by taking that for granted and flirting with the far right in order to hold on to working class and middle class white voters, we really run the risk of losing the future. And I can't help as a Californian, but having that lesson really drilled into me, because, you know, California politics was one of the first places where we saw Trump style aggressive xenophobia and anti-immigrant politics from the Republicans. it was great for them in the short term. They beat us. They actually took the legislature from us. They beat us in statewide races for Senate and for governor especially. And luckily, the Democrats, by and large, didn't take the bait, remained pro-immigrant. And now the Republican Party is a joke here. And we've been able to reap the benefits of holding the line while demography changed. I really worry for some of my comrades in Europe that they're going to be making this short-term tack to the right on these issues in order to stop the bleeding of some of their traditional voters. But it will mean alienating voters of color, young voters, and that will end up dying along with that old voter base.
I'm speaking with a political consultant, Jerocca Larimore Hall.
Okay, so what about the Democrats? What's their social base?
The Sweden Democrats?
Yeah, the Sweden Democrats, not your Democrats. Yes, the Sweden Democrats.
So the Sweden Democrats voter base is, you know, a chunk of disaffected working class voters in the small, especially in rural areas and small cities. The way that Sweden developed their industrial base over the last couple of hundred years, a lot of the factories, manufacturing areas and so forth are not in big cities, but rather in the countryside. And it's sort of similar to the way that the Midwest developed, that you'd have an auto plant or a steel plant out in the countryside and then several small towns that depended on it for their livelihood. Those plants have closed in large part because of, you know, pressures of globalization and the way that the Nordic countries sort of handle trade shocks is to kind of, you know, go with the flow. They don't do a lot of like trying to protect industries that aren't able to be competitive globally. And so those people have gone from, you know, high paying industrial jobs to lower paying service jobs. And the Sweden Democrats have been able to capitalize on that. As in a lot of places, especially in Central Europe, they tend to do better in places where there are fewer immigrants and fewer people of color, right? People who go to work every day and say hi to Mohammed on the way and work with Maria and so forth, you know, are like, hey, the sky doesn't fall when there are brown people around me. People who've never seen them or only see them rarely are more susceptible to that xenophobia. And then they do actually have pockets of support, and this is where they're very clever. But they'll get pockets of support from immigrant groups, non-Muslim immigrant groups, using an explicitly Islamophobic appeal. And this reminded me a lot in why I think that there is actually quite a bit of explicit coordination and idea sharing between our far right and theirs. If you remember in the Republican convention, Trump had this, there was one night, it was all about, you know, undocumented, vilifying undocumented immigrants. And they put up this like Benetton ad of folks talking about how they'd been victimized or lost their children to nefarious undocumented immigrants to try to get them on their side and be very focused about who the boogeyman was. The Sweden Democrats have done that too. So they'll get support from Eastern European immigrants. They'll get support from immigrant groups from the Middle East who have been in Sweden for longer and feel like they've done the work of assimilation and new immigrants or new migrants aren't doing that. They'll get Christian Arabs on their side who come to Sweden with experiences of civil war, sectarian violence in their home countries. And they're able to sort of elevate those leaders or those communities up to the top in order to, you know, deny that this is about race or this is racism. That's their coalition. And there's a lot of research that shows that, you know, they have a real ceiling of support, that far right parties across Europe really can't break about a 25% threshold. But with the way that Swedish politics is, and the way that their parliamentary system works, you know, a steady 20% or even high teens vote by the Sweden Democrats makes absolute chaos when it comes to putting governments together.
Well, then, of course, if that 20-25% serves has the effect of pulling the more mainstream parties in their direction, then they punch
exactly
way above their weight. Yeah, that sounds somewhat also like Doug Ford in Toronto, who has a substantial base in immigrant communities as well.
Yeah.
A bit of history here. About 10, 12 years ago, it actually predates that, but about 10, 12 years ago, there was an intensification of austerity in Sweden, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what sort of cuts we've seen to the welfare state and what effects that might have had.
Yeah, so there's been a rash of privatization, mostly under the conservative governments or the conservative coalition governments. you know, I will say that there's been a drift to the sort of neoliberal right in the social democratic parties in the Nordic countries, but nothing on the scale of, you know, what happened with Blair or Schroeder. The most right-wing policies or platforms that came out of the Labour parties in Sweden or Norway or Denmark would still look vigorously progressive in most countries. But so it's been mainly under right-wing governments that you've seen privatizations, you've seen cuts to unemployment benefits, you've seen deregulations of the labor market, creating more part-time jobs, zero-hour appointments. And the way that their labor movement has protected workers, you know, has not been with closed shops. It's been with pattern bargaining across industries, coordinated between the trade union confederation, the employers federation, and the government, but with more and more people working as freelancers, part-timers, working in the service sector, it's been harder to integrate that into the corporatist system for managing wages and working conditions. So there's been the growth of a precariat there, and you know, not just, you know, young people entering the labor market, but people in middle age and people who expected, looking at their parents and grandparents' generation, that they would have, you know, life security and social security from cradle to the grave, now seeing that that's not true. The effects of that has been a widening of income and wealth inequality. Again, nothing compared to continental Europe or the United States, but still something that's shocking for a regular, you know, everyday Swedish person who's not used to seeing big differences in society, not used to seeing people begging on the street, not used to seeing homeless people, not used to seeing a very, very wealthy and arrogant elite call for further weakening of social security and so forth. And it's worth saying that what the right wing did, particularly in Sweden, was a kind of mirror image of Blairism, in that they campaigned starting about 14 years ago. They changed their name to the New Moderates. It's strange. The main conservative party in Sweden is known as the Moderate Party. But they actually still to this day use in their logo, like, the New Moderates. And we're like, hey, we like the welfare state. We just think that you've got to, you know, be tougher on immigration. You've got to be tougher on welfare fraud. You've got to, you know, loosen up access to the market for new companies in order to build the tax base to support the welfare state. So it's not like they come in and are like, hey, free markets are the best and we're going to destroy the welfare model. We're going to destroy the Swedish model. They market themselves as an updating of the Swedish model. I mean, that's the good news, is that the core assumptions of the welfare state, the core assumptions of social democracy, remain popular and majoritarian in Sweden. And now there's a fight over the legacy of it. Are the social democrats the architects of it, and so should we keep them in office and in power because they know how to run a welfare state? Is this new idea of a whites-only welfare state, or kick the immigrants out to save the welfare state, or do we update it with some, you know, market tinkering around the edges in order to make it more competitive? That's the debate.
Finally, the base of the Democrats, Sweden Democrats that you talked about, sound rather familiar to the U.S., you know, what a lot of the Trump voters, the people that Hillary Clinton called deplorables. I mean, I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis, who are truly deplorable, but people who are really losers in the 21st century economy, who are thrashing about looking for enemies and striking at the weaker portions of society and not the stronger. How can we think and talk constructively about that stratum of society so we don't push them to the right?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's hard, and it's especially hard with these guys because there's so many of their leaders and representatives are freaking Nazis. I mean, it's like you have to confront that. And there's a real danger in saying, like, oh, well, we don't want to alienate their voters, so, you know, let's not vilify them too much, when they're bona fide racist jerks. You know, that it's trickier. I think that it's important to build a longer term, more robustly and explicitly anti-racist movement in these countries. We've got to be out in these communities talking about, you know, giving an alternative worldview to this idea that it's the immigrants that are responsible for them falling behind. We certainly have to avoid the Hillary Clinton mistake of just, you know, going and lecturing them that, you know, they've never had it so good, so why are they talking like this? we certainly have to avoid pushing people into their hands by or into their arms by sounding exactly like them. What exactly the magic bullet is for going in and undoing their coalition at the grassroots, I wish I had that. I don't have that. But as a political consultant who believes very, very much in field as a political activist that came up from grassroots organizing and social movements, you know, I think that there's a longer and medium term effort that we have to do of being back integrated into those communities and those areas, becoming trusted again there, but being firm and offering a different worldview. Honestly, I think we've got to bring a little bit more class resentment back to the mix and a narrative about who's really benefiting from the current arrangement. And it's not the person that who risked their life in harrowing circumstances, you know, to go overland from the worst civil war of our lifetime to make it all the way close to the Arctic Circle in order to not be killed. That's not the enemy. But being consistent about that, repeating that over and over again, repeating that through the faith, faith movements, through community organizations, through educational institutions, and so forth, to try, at least to make sure that the younger voters, that kids today are getting a different worldview and growing up with a different worldview, so that this does not become a permanent voting block. That's the ultimate strategy.
But by bringing that class resentment back in, we don't want to turn away from the hideous reality of racism and xenophobia and pretend it doesn't exist because it's too uncomfortable to talk about, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's a challenge for the European left in general, and I think the Nordic left in particular, because, you know, since World War II, there's been a consensus that, you know, talking about race, that's what Nazis do. Right. Nazis talked about race. In this new society, we know that race is a fiction. So we don't even talk about it, which has kind of disarmed the left from having the kind of tools to talk about how the ideology of racism works, how racialization works, etc. And they've literally, you know, in a place like Sweden, had in the last 5 years to develop the intellectual or political tools, analytical tools that we've been developing over 200 years. You know, kind of all of a sudden a crash course in how to talk about this. And it's been, you know, obviously mixed results, and it's a difficult one. I chuckled to myself so many times during the great Hillary-Bernie wars when Clinton folks would accuse Bernie of being some kind of vulgar Marxist, unreconstructed white class guy. And I'm like, this guy is like a Black Panther compared to so many of the social democratic and communist and socialist left in Scandinavia, who really are ideologically hostile to talking about race too much. So they've got some growing to do in that, but they start with a basis of a strong, well-funded, well-organized labor movement, a strong, relatively disciplined political party or set of political parties, because I would include the left socialist parties in our family as well. So we have institutionally, things that we could only dream about in the left in the United States. They need to supplement that with a newly energized and robust anti-racism that they're willing to fight for and stand by.
How is Duraca Larimore Hall, one of two vice chairs of the California Democratic Party and a consultant to social democratic parties and unions in Europe, including the Swedish Social Dems? I want to underscore the final point of that interview. There's a common view on parts of the left that racism and xenophobia are best fought by ignoring them and presenting a positive universal program as a distraction instead. A positive universal program, say Medicare for all and a $15 an hour minimum wage, can be a powerful antidote to bigotry. But we're not doing anyone any favors by not facing head-on the sort of highly racialized police violence discussed in the first interview or the anti-immigrant xenophobia in the second. And while we can partly explain the increasing salience of the hateful tendencies in politics by the neoliberal turn of the last 3.5 decades, we shouldn't use that as an excuse. These are treacherous waters hard to navigate, but we do have to take them on. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the second of 8 piano pieces by Hans Eisler, performed by Matt Rubinstein, a frequent recorded guest on this show, and a listener. Eisler, born in Austria in 1898, was blacklisted first by the Nazis and then by the House Un-American Activities Committee and Hollywood studio bosses. He collaborated frequently with Bertolt Brecht and wrote, among many other things, the East German National Anthem. Till next week, bye.
Thank you.